was likely a Christian himself. If not, he was certainly well-disposed toward Christianity and relied heavily on Christian Mongols in his administration. The Pope's letter chastised the Mongols for invading Europe, ordering the Khan to desist entirely from assaults of this kind, and especially from the persecution of Christians. He demanded an explanation from the Khan to make fully known to us what moved you to destroy other nations and what your intentions are for the future. The letter informed the Khan that God had delegated all earthly power to the Pope in Rome, who was the only person authorized by God to speak for him. After the Mongol officials found out that Carpini brought no tribute and offered no submission, they mostly ignored him. But in a letter of November 1246 that still survives, Gulyuk asked Innocent IV the obvious questions. How do you know whom God absolves and to whom he shows mercy? How do you know that God sanctions the words you speak? Gulyuk pointed out that God had given the Mongols, not the Pope, control of the world from the rising sun to the setting sun. God intended for the Mongols to spread his commandments and his laws through Genghis Khan's great law. He then advised the Pope to come to Karakorum with all of his princes in order to pay homage to the Mongol Khan. The first direct diplomatic contact between Europe and the Far East had degenerated into an exchange of comparative theology, mixed with religious insults. Despite the extensive spiritual beliefs that the Mongols and Europeans shared in common, the opening relationship had been so negative and misguided that in future years, the entire base of shared religion would eventually erode. The Mongols continued for another generation to foster closer relations with Christian Europe, but in the end, they would have to abandon all such hope. And with it, they would, in time, abandon Christianity entirely in favor of Buddhism and Islam. In the fall of 1246, when Carpini and the other foreign dignitaries departed the royal camp to head home, Gulyuk turned attention from public pomp and ceremony to the important political task of solidifying power and making himself the Khan in fact as well as in title. To assert his newly conferred powers, he first attacked Fatima, his mother's trusted advisor. Using an accusation of witchcraft against her as a pretext, he summoned Fatima from his mother's court to his own. His mother refused to let her go. He sent again several times, and each time she refused him in a different way. As a result, his relations with his mother became very bad, and he sent a man with instruction to bring Fatima by force if his mother should still delay. The vague records of what happened next raised more questions than answers. Gulyuk won control of Fatima Hatun, and his mother died. Was his mother ill? Killed? Did she die of anger or grief? Most records fall silent. The Persian historian Juzjani wrote that Torajan was sent to join her husband, Ogode. Since her husband had been dead for 6 years, the statement appears to be a euphemism for her death. But Juzjani seemed unsure, for he added, "But God knows the truth." All we know is that Gulyuk's men seized Fatima Hatun, and Torajan Hatun was dead. Instead of quietly disposing of Fatima, Gulyuk submitted her to a gruesome public ordeal. At a time when the Mongols ruled an empire across two continents and still had numerous opportunities to expand it even farther, the court seemed fixated not on the empire, but on this one woman, what she had done and what should be done to her. Gulyuk ordered his guards to bring Fatima, stripped naked and tightly bound in ropes, before him in open court. There she was kept publicly hungry and thirsty for many days and nights. They beat her and then flogged her with some kind of heated metal rods. Such a public torture may have been appropriate for the treatment of a witch in European society, or for a heretic at the hands of the Christian Church. But it violated totally the practices of Genghis Khan, who slew his enemies and ruled with harsh strictness, but steadfastly without torture or the infliction of unnecessary pain. It seemed particularly contrary to Mongol tradition, since it was directed against a woman. No precedent was known in Mongol history for any comparable spectacle. The torture of Fatima was perhaps technically legal under the existing code because she was not a Mongol nor married to one, but instead a war captive of uncertain but unprotected status. When at last the tortured woman confessed to a list of evils, including bewitching Turajin Khatun and other members of the Golden Family, Guyuk imposed on her a punishment of unique cruelty and symbolism. He ordered that all the orifices of her upper and lower body be sewn shut, thereby not permitting any of the essences of her soul to escape from her body, and that she be rolled up inside a felt blanket and drowned in the river. And thus ended the life of Fatima, his mother's advisor, and one of the most powerful women of the 13th century. In keeping with the tone set by the public torture and execution of Fatima, Guyuk's short reign was one of horrible revenge. He unleashed a crude campaign to consolidate power and eliminate rivals. He ordered his soldiers to hunt down and kill everyone connected with Fatima. He began legal proceedings against his uncle Temug Ochigen, the last surviving full brother of Genghis Khan, and thus a legal claimant to the throne, who, shortly before Guyuk's election, had pressed his claim in an abortive attempt to raise an army and invade the lands of Turajin Khatun. Temug Ochigen had survived his encounter with the shaman Teb Tengger when he was younger, but he did not survive this confrontation with his grandnephew. In a secret trial closely supervised by Guyuk in a closed gur, the male members of the family condemned him to death for attempting to seize the office of Great Khan by military force rather than election. Guyuk turned attention to the other women in charge of the imperial Mongol lands. He removed the regent widow ruling over the lands of Chagatai's family, and he ordered an inquiry into the affairs of Tolu's estate, then under the regency of Tsohortan, who had refused to marry Guyuk after her husband's death. During the investigation, he ordered the surrender of all the warriors assigned to her and her sons. With his eastern front thus secured and under his tight control, he assembled his army to move west on what he claimed was to be a massive hunt. In fact, the move was a pretext for a surprise attack on Bat Khan in Russia. He not only wanted revenge against his cousin for prior insults at the victory dinner in Russia, but of all the Khans, Guyuk seemed most convinced of the importance of Europe. He wanted to complete that conquest and add Europe to his own personal territory within the Mongol Empire. Unwilling to defy him publicly in any way, Sohortan cautiously moved to ensure that he failed in a surprise attack. She secretly dispatched messengers to warn Bada Guyuk's plan. She quite possibly took direct action against Guyuk himself, because once he left his family stronghold in the central Mongolian steppe, the 43-year-old, seemingly healthy Guyuk suddenly died of mysterious causes after only 18 months in office. Someone had probably killed him, but the list of suspects who had cause to do so is too long to analyze. No surviving Mongol document records the details of his death, and the suddenly laconic Persian chronicles report merely that his predestined hour arrived. In the continuing political struggles at the center of the empire, the fringes began to unravel. With his great love of metaphors, Juveni wrote that the affairs of the world had been diverted from the path of rectitude, and the reins of commerce and fair dealing turned aside from the highway of righteousness. He described the land as being in darkness, and the cup of the world was filled to the brim with the drink of iniquity. The Mongol people and their subjects, dragged now this way, now that, were at their wits' end, for they had neither the endurance to stay, nor did they know of a place to which they might flee. After the brief respite of Guyuk's rule, the battle of the surviving queens resumed, even more intensely, as Guyuk's widow, Ogulhemish, stepped forward to take control of the empire, just as her mother-in-law Torijin had done when Ogedei died. Ogulhemish lacked the skills of her mother-in-law, and the hour would not belong to her, in great part because her own sons set up rival courts to challenge her right to rule as regent. Sohortan, with the full support of her four capable sons and a lifetime of preparation and waiting, finally made her move. Rather than wait for Guyuk's widow to call the Hurultai at the capital of Karakorum, Bat Khan, at the instigation of his secret ally Sohortan, called it in 1250 for an area near Lake Issyk-Kul in the Tian Shan Mountains, outside of Mongolia, and more convenient for him to reach. The Hurultai elected Sohortan's eldest son Monk, but the Ogedei family boycotted the election on grounds that a legitimate election had to be held in Mongolia proper, in particular in the capital of Karakorum, which their family controlled. Undaunted, Sohortan devised a brilliant plan. She lacked access to the imperial capital, but as the widow of Genghis Khan's youngest son, she controlled the ancient family homeland where Genghis Khan had been born, elected, and buried. No one could refuse to attend a Hurultai held on this sacred ground. Her ally, Bat Khan, could not make the long trip from Russia, but he sent her a bodyguard of 30,000 troops under his brother Berk to protect her and her family through this election and installation process. She organized a second election for this hallowed spot, and on July 1, 1251, the assembled throng proclaimed the 43-year-old monk Grand Khan of the Mongol Empire. This time, no one could object to the venue. To celebrate the occasion of his election, Monk issued an order that for that day each person should rest, and the animals should not be made to work or carry burdens. The earth should not be pierced with tent pegs, and water should not be polluted. No one could hunt wild animals, and those animals that were to be killed for feasting should be killed without shedding blood on the sacred earth. After the sacred day, a week of feasting followed. Each day of the festivities, the assembled guests consumed 300 horses or oxen, 3,000 sheep, and 2,000 wagons filled with irak, the beloved alcoholic drink made from fermented mare's milk. The celebration marked the culmination of Sohortan's life work, and in one sense, the celebration was more of an honor for her than anyone else. Whereas Genghis Khan himself had produced sons who were relatively weak, prone to drink, and self-centered, she had produced and trained four sons destined to make a major mark in history. Each of her sons was a Khan. In the coming years, Monk, Arik Bok, and Kublai would all carry the title of Great Khan for various lengths of time, and her other son Hulek would become the Il Khan of Persia and the founder of his own dynasty there. Her sons would push the empire to its maximum size by conquering all of Persia, Baghdad, Syria, and Turkey. They would conquer the Chinese Sung dynasty in the south and push into Vietnam, Laos, and Burma. They would destroy the dreaded sect of the assassins and execute the Muslim caliph. The family of Ogedei and Guyuk arrived late at the Hurultai, after the election itself, but in the middle of the celebration. The three important princes of Ogedei's family suddenly strode into the tent to announce that they wished to pay obeisance to the new Khan. The new Khan had them all arrested and put in chains, because his spies already reported that their arrival was a ruse to distract the court, while other members of the family gathered nearby to prepare a sneak attack on the celebrating and therefore inebriated throng. Monk easily captured the would-be attackers and began another round of trials. He could not torture or shed the blood of any descendant of Genghis Khan, but he had their advisers, mostly Muslims and Chinese, brought in for a torturous whipping with canes until they confessed against their masters. At the end of the trial, the new Khan found his cousins guilty of various crimes. Two of the princes had their mouths stuffed with stones and dirt until they died. Some of the advisers committed suicide. In all, Monk executed 77 people within or close to Ogaday's lineage. While Monk oversaw the trials of the men, his mother tried the women in her court. Sorhortan ordered the arrest of the hapless regent Ogul Hamish Khatun, and in an only slightly milder replay of the trial of Fatima, her captors sewed rawhide around her hands and stripped her naked for public ridicule before wrapping her in felt and drowning her and another senior woman from the family. A third woman from their family was wrapped in a blanket and kicked to death. From his court, Monk Khan expanded the trials to a grand purge by sending out bands of inquisitors throughout the empire to question, convict, and punish anyone suspected of disloyalty to his branch of the family. The trials took place on a global scale, from China and Mongolia in the east to Afghanistan in the south, and Persia and Iraq in the west. Even the highest officials, such as the ruler of the Uyghurs, were put to death. But the greatest damage was inflicted on the Golden Family itself. Monk seemed determined to root out all the supporters from the families of his deceased uncles Chagatai and Ogaday. Monk seized the city of Karakorum and surrounding territory from Ogaday's descendants. Across the empire, rulers and high officials, lucky enough to escape punishment by the ad hoc tribunals, still had to travel to Karakorum and present themselves to the new Khan, have their record of loyalty examined, and then face the possible threat of punishment. Those officials who survived the test were then reinstated in their old position by the new Khan. After the extensive and bloody purge of the Ogaday lineage, Monk Khan ordered a general amnesty for other types of non-political prisoners and captives. Power had clearly passed into the lineage of Tolu. Sohortan had smashed the last obstacles to power for her sons, and she died knowing that her four sons faced no further threat from any branch of the Golden Family. The best description made of her accomplishment came from the writer Bar Hebraeus, who wrote that, "If I were to see among the race of women another woman like this, I should say that the race of women was far superior to men. No one in the history of the world had been given so large and rich an empire as Sorhortan gave to her sons. But within a few years of her death, her four sons would begin to tear it apart." Sometime near the Mongol New Year festival in February 1252, either in the final days of the Year of the Pig or the first days of the Year of the Rat, Sorhortan died. With her death, the decade of the ruling women that had begun in 1241 ended. Even as they competed against one another, the women had brought much-needed outside talent into the inner circle of Mongol rule, and had given the empire a new foundation with their support of monasteries and schools, the printing of books, and the exchange of ideas and knowledge. After the resumption of the Mongol World War by the men, it would, in the end, be the new institutions begun by these women that would have the greatest impact on the world within and beyond the Mongol Empire. But the full flowering of that would have to await one more round of war. Monk's accession to the office of Great Khan of the Mongol Empire in 1251 came nearly a quarter of a century after the death of his grandfather, Genghis Khan, in 1227. In a statement that summarizes his administration and his sober personality as instilled in him by his mother, Sorhotan, he said of himself, "I follow the laws of my ancestors. I do not imitate other countries' ways." He was a serious man who showed neither the frivolity of Ogode nor the recklessness of Guyuk, and who, almost alone among members of the Golden Family, avoided the destructive bind of alcoholism. To increase his legitimacy as the great Khan of the Mongol Empire, and to rewrite history to make it more accommodating to his needs, in 1252, he retroactively awarded his father the title of Great Khan. This was given on the legal claim that as the youngest son, and therefore the Ochagan, or Prince of the Hearth, Tolu had been entitled to inherit his deceased father's titles as well as his homeland. In staking out his territory, Monk turned attention to his newly claimed capital city of Karakorum, which for 20 years had served as the center and symbol of the power of Ogode's family. Monk, however, intended to transform the modest city from the family seat of Ogode's lineage into an imperial capital of the Mongol Empire. Before Ogode built Karakorum, the area had belonged to the Caryat, and in particular to Ong Khan and his family, including Sorhotan, Monk's mother, and the niece of Ong Khan. He needed to make his own mark on the capital, and since Ogode had already used Chinese and Persian architects, Monk turned to the Christian craftsmen captured in his part of the European campaign. Although he showed no appreciation for European architecture, the technical ability of the metalworkers had impressed him. When his army took the city of Belgrade, they had captured Guillaume Boucher, a Parisian goldsmith. Because of his ability to make Christian religious objects, Boucher had been given to Sorhotan, and on her death he passed to Monk's younger brother, Arik Bok. Monk selected Boucher, together with a team of 50 assistant craftsmen, to add an exotic European flair to the Mongol capital. And he did so in an overwhelming but idiosyncratic style that amazed visitors to his courts. Envoys to Monk's court at Karakorum reported the working of an unusual contraption in his palace. A large tree, sculpted of silver and other precious metals, rose up from the middle of his courtyard and loomed over his palace, with the branches of the tree extending into the building and along the rafters. Silver fruit hung from the limbs, and it had 4 golden serpents braided around the trunk. At the top of the tree rose a triumphant angel, also cast in silver, holding a trumpet at his side. An intricate series of pneumatic tubes inside the tree allowed unseen servants to blow into them and manipulate them to produce what seemed to be acts of magic. When the Khan wanted to summon drinks for his guests, the mechanical angel raised the trumpet to his lips and sounded the horn, whereupon the mouths of the serpents began to gush out a fountain of alcoholic beverages into large silver basins arranged at the base of the tree. Each pipe discharged a different drink: wine, black arak, rice wine, and mead. The 4 serpents on the silver tree of Karakorum symbolized the 4 directions in which the Mongol Empire extended, as did the 4 alcoholic drinks derived from crops of distant and exotic civilizations: grapes, milk, rice, and honey. Trees were rare on the steppe, but they had a more important role in the homeland and origin of the Mongol family of Genghis Khan. In their oral history, the first ancestor to try to unite the Mongol tribes had been made Khan under a tree on the Horhonak steppe, and it was in this same area that Temujin and Jamukha had taken the oath as Andas after the Merkid battle. The whole contraption offered a spectacular and pungent reminder of the Mongol origins and of their mission to conquer the entire world in all four directions. Monk accepted the obligation to bring everything under the rule of the Mongol state that stood like one massive tree at the center of the universe. Mong Khan took that command as the literal destiny of his nation, and as his responsibility to achieve. As part of his more Western orientation, Christianity temporarily resumed its ascendancy in Monk's court, a trend reinforced by the large number of Christian wives in the Golden Family, and by the steadfast loyalty shown by Christian nations such as Georgia and Armenia. Near the end of 1253, the year of the ox, William of Rubruck, a Franciscan monk, came to the Mongol court as an envoy from the French king. From his writings, an intriguing, although not always detailed, description emerged of the rivalries among the Christians and other religions in the Mongol court. Rubruck had the opportunity to see how the Mongol court celebrated Christmas, although he himself had little role to play other than singing Veni Sancte Spiritus for them. Mong Khan and his wife celebrated Mass in church, with the two of them seated on a golden couch across from the altar. In keeping with Assyrian Christian tradition, the inside was void of excessive decoration and imagery, but the rafters of the church were draped with silk to give the building the feeling and appearance of a Mongol gur. After Mass, the Khan talked about religion for a short while with the priests. When he left, his wife stayed behind to distribute Christmas presents to everyone. She offered gifts of textiles to Rubruck, but he refused to accept them. Apparently, the Hatun did not notice the intended slight. Since Rubruck's interpreter accepted the cloth for himself and later sold it back in Cyprus. After the distribution of gifts, the Christmas celebration began with goblets of red wine, rice ale, and the ubiquitous Mongol irak. The French envoys had to sing once again for the Hatun. Finally, after several more rounds of drinks, the Christmas dinner arrived in the form of large platters of mutton and carp, which Rubruck contemptuously noted was served without salt or bread. "I ate a little. In this way they passed the time until evening." The Christmas Mass and celebration ended when the lady, now drunk, got into a cart while the priest sang and howled, and she went her way. The Mongol Christians emphasized the association of God with light, particularly the golden light that was sacred in their mythology. And they associated Jesus with healing and triumph of life over death. Despite the common religion, Rubruck greatly resented the Assyrian, Armenian, and Orthodox Christians of the Mongol court. Since he considered all non-Catholics to be heretics, he contemptuously designated the Mongol congregants of the Assyrian church as Nestorians, in reference to Nestorius, the 5th century patriarch of Constantinople, who was condemned as a heretic by the Council of Ephesus in 431. Among the Assyrian beliefs that Rubruck held to be heretical was that the Virgin Mary was the mother of Christ, but not the mother of God. They also differed from the Catholics in their steadfast refusal to portray Christ on the cross as a violation of the Mongol taboos on depicting death or blood. Even when they admitted to being Christians, Mongols did not consider their religion as their primary identification. As one of the Mongol generals, who was a follower of Christianity, explained, he was no Christian. He was a Mongol. After making the French envoy wait for many months, Monk finally received him officially in court on May 24, 1254. Rubruck informed the officials that he knew the word of God and had come to spread it. In front of the assembled representatives of the various religions, The Khan asked Rubruk to explain to them the word of God.
Rubruk stumbled over a few phrases and stressed the importance to Christians of the commandment to love God, whereupon one of the Muslim clerics asked him incredulously, "Is there any man who does not love God?"
Rubruk responded, "Those who do not keep his commandments do not love him." Another cleric then asked Rubruk, "Have you been in heaven that you know the commandments of God?"
He seized upon the implication of what Rubruk was saying to them about God's commandments and challenged him directly.
"By this, you mean that Mong Khan does not observe God's commandments?"
The discussion continued for some time, and according to Rubruk's own account, it was obvious that he did not fare well in the sometimes acrimonious arguments. He was unaccustomed to debating with people who did not share his basic assumptions of Catholic Christianity. Evidently, Mong Khan recognized the problems he was having and suggested that all the scholars present take time to write out their thoughts more clearly and then return for a fuller discussion and debate of the issues. The Mongols loved competitions of all sorts, and they organized debates among rival religions the same way they organized wrestling matches. It began on a specific date with a panel of judges to oversee it. In this case, Mong Khan ordered them to debate before three judges, a Christian, a Muslim, and a Buddhist. A large audience assembled to watch the affair, which began with great seriousness and formality. An official laid down the strict rules by which Mong wanted the debate to proceed. On pain of death, no one shall dare to speak words of contention. Rubruk and the other Christians joined together in one team with the Muslims in an effort to refute the Buddhist doctrines. As these men gathered together in all their robes and regalia in the tents and the dusty plains of Mongolia, they were doing something that no other set of scholars or theologians had ever done in history. It is doubtful that representatives of so many types of Christianity had come to a single meeting, and certainly they had not debated as equals with representatives of the various Muslim and Buddhist faiths. The religious scholars had to compete on the basis of their beliefs and ideas, using no weapons or the authority of any ruler or army behind them. They could use only words and logic to test the ability of their ideas to persuade. In the initial round, Rubruk faced a Buddhist from North China, who began by asking how the world was made and what happened to the soul after death. Rubruk countered that the Buddhist monk was asking the wrong questions. The first issue should be about God from whom all things flow. The umpires awarded the first points to Rubruk. Their debate ranged back and forth over the topics of evil versus good, God's nature, what happens to the souls of animals, the existence of reincarnation, and whether God had created evil. As they debated, the clerics formed shifting coalitions among the various religions according to the topic. Between each round of wrestling, Mongol athletes would drink fermented mare's milk. In keeping with that tradition, after each round of the debate, the learned men paused to drink deeply in preparation for the next match. No side seemed to convince the other of anything. Finally, as the effects of the alcohol became stronger, the Christians gave up trying to persuade anyone with logical arguments and resorted to singing. The Muslims, who did not sing, responded by loudly reciting the Quran in an effort to drown out the Christians, and the Buddhists retreated into silent meditation. At the end of the debate, unable to convert or kill one another, they concluded the way most Mongol celebrations concluded, with everyone simply too drunk to continue. While the clerics debated at Karakorum, their religious brethren were hacking at each other and burning one another alive in other parts of the world, outside the Mongol Empire.
At almost the same time of Rubruk's debate in Mongolia, his sponsor, King Louis IX, was busy rounding up all Talmudic texts and other books of the Jews. The devout king had the Hebrew manuscripts heaped into great piles and set afire. During Rubruk's absence from France, his fellow countrymen burned some 12,000 handwritten and illuminated Jewish books. For these and other great services to the furtherance of the gospel of Jesus Christ, his church canonized him as Saint Louis, thereby making him a figure of veneration that good Christians could emulate and to whom they could pray as an intermediary between humans and God. During the same time in both the Muslim and Christian kingdoms, the rulers made religious intolerance an official policy of the state. Frustrated in the attempts to conquer the Holy Land or to expand into Eastern Europe, the Catholic Church moved into a phase of growing intolerance for religious variation at home. In 1255, the Church sanctioned the torturing of people suspected of heretical beliefs, and priests, mostly Dominicans, began traveling from city to city to find and torture suspects. Until this time, civil authorities used torture to interrogate suspected criminals, traitors, and war prisoners, but priests did not inflict torture for religious purposes. A few days after the debate at Karakorum, Mong Khan summoned Rubruk to discharge him and send him back to his home country. He took this occasion to explain to the priest, and through him to the rulers of Europe, that he himself belonged to no single religion. And he lectured Rubruk on Mongol beliefs about tolerance and goodness. "We Mongols believe in one God, by whom we live and whom we die, and toward him we have an upright heart." He then explained, "Just as God gave different fingers to the hand, so has he given different ways to men. To you, God has given the scriptures, and you Christians do not observe them." He cited as evidence that the Christians eagerly placed money ahead of justice. He then explained that instead of the scriptures, God had given the Mongols holy men, their shaman. "In daily life, we do what they tell us and live in peace with one another." Mong Khan then sent a letter to the French King Louis IX. It had a simple message. "In heaven there is but one eternal God, and on earth there is but one Lord, Genghis Khan, the son of God, and his descendants who ruled the Mongol Empire." Aside from this messianic rhetoric, added after Genghis Khan's death, the main message remained the same as articulated by the founder of the Mongol Empire in his latter years. Once all people submit to the tolerant rule of the Mongols, then by the power of the eternal God, the whole world, from the rising of the sun to going down, thereof shall be at one in joy and peace. But Monk warned the French and all Christians that if, when you hear and understand the decree of the eternal God, you are unwilling to pay attention and believe it, saying, "Our country is far away, our mountains are might, our sea is vast, and in this confidence you bring an army against us, we know what we can do." Despite his theological interrogation of Rubruk, Monk's interest in him was primarily diplomatic and commercial, not religious. Under Monk, the entire energy of the state and the Golden Family was redirected toward the original enterprises that Genghis Khan had left unfinished: the conquest of the Sung Dynasty and the Arab states of the Middle East. To get the empire back on track, Monk ordered a series of censuses to record the number of people and animals, as well as the orchards and farms and other assets of the empire. Local officials forwarded the information to Karakorum in great registers that supplied Monk with a detailed demographic and economic portrait of his massive realm. He used this information to plan his policies, organize taxes, and recruit soldiers and laborers. His centralized control of information gave him heightened power over local areas and provided him with more oversight of local officials. To renew the war campaigns, Monk needed to stabilize the economy, control government spending, and confront the massive debts accumulated by Guyuk and other administrators over the prior decade. In his short and disastrous reign, Guyuk had purchased vast amounts of goods and paid for them with paper drafts on the promise that the paper could be converted into gold or silver by the merchant when needed. With Guyuk dead, many local officials and advisors no longer wanted to pay off these bills issued by the late Khan. Monk, however, astutely recognized that if he did not meet the financial obligations of Guyuk, it would make merchants and other foreigners reluctant to continue business with the Mongols. Monk Khan's decision to pay those debts prompted Juveni to ask, "And from what book of history has it been read or heard that a king paid the debt of another king?" In a commercial world not yet accustomed to dealing with paper currency, Monk grasped the importance of sustaining faith and purity in the monetary system. Genghis Khan had authorized the use of paper money, backed by precious metals and silk, shortly before his death in 1227. The practice grew erratically in the coming years, but by the time of Monk Khan's reign, it became necessary to limit the paper money supply in ways that it was not necessary to do with gold and silver coins. Monk recognized the dangers incurred by earlier administrations that issued paper money and debt on an ad hoc basis. And in 1253, he created a Department of Monetary Affairs to control and standardize the issuance of paper money. The superintendent of the agency centralized control to prevent the overissue of paper money and the erosion of its value through inflation. The Mongols allowed each nation under its control to continue minting coins in the denominations and weight they had traditionally used, but they established a universal measure based on the suk, a silver ingot divided into 500 parts, to which each of the local currencies was tied. This standardization of varied currencies relative to the suk eased problems in accounting and currency exchange for both merchants and government administrators. Thus, standardization of currency allowed Monk Khan to monetize taxes rather than accepting payment in local goods. In turn, the monetization allowed for standardized budgeting procedures for his imperial administration, since instead of accepting taxes and goods, the Mongols increasingly accepted them in money. Rather than relying on government officials to collect and reallocate tribute of grains, arrows, silk, fur, oil, and other commodities, the government increasingly moved money rather than goods. For the first time, a standardized unit of account could be used from China to Persia. So long as the Mongols maintained control of money, they could let merchants assume responsibility for the movement of goods without any loss of government power. In Karakorum in the spring of 1253, with the finances of the empire on solid footing, Monk summoned his siblings and close family to a small kurultai to plan their new policies and undertakings. Now that they exercised firm control over the core of the Mongol Empire, what should they do with it? The families of two of Genghis Khan's sons, Ogode and Chagatai, had been crushed and deprived of most of their holdings. The third branch, the descendants of Joch, with whom Sorhotan had made her effective alliance, had been in effect granted their independence to rule over Russia and the European territories as they saw fit. Monk Khan was ready to resume the expansion of the Mongol Empire, but he sought to do so in a way that primarily benefited himself and his brothers, rather than the many cousins, the other grandchildren of Genghis Khan. Despite his fondness for European contraptions and design, Monk showed no interest in launching another campaign in that direction. He returned to the dual campaigns of Genghis Khan against the Sung dynasty of South China and the Muslim civilization of the Arabs and Persians. Monk assigned Hulek, the brother with the best military training, to take the army of the right with the plan to attack the Arab cities of Baghdad, Damascus, and Cairo. Monk assigned Kublai, who, despite his lack of military experience, had a deep knowledge of Chinese culture, to lead the army of the left to conquer the Sung dynasty. As Great Khan, Monk remained at the center in Mongolia, while Arikbok, their youngest brother and therefore the prince of the hearth for their family, stayed behind to assist him in managing the empire. In May 1253, Hulek and Kublai headed off to complete the two conquests ordered by their grandfather and now reaffirmed by their eldest brother. In the customary Mongol preparation for invasion, Hulek had already dispatched advanced troops across Central Asia to clear the path of all herds in order to ensure a good supply of pasture when the main army passed through the area. Hulek allowed his vanguard to probe enemy forces and initiate diplomatic negotiations with potential allies before the threat of his massive army appeared. The main army gathered in the summer to fatten their horses, and in traditional Mongol style, would campaign only in winter. Unlike Genghis Khan's warriors, who moved with lightning speed and approached the Muslim cities from several directions at once, Hulek deliberately advanced more slowly and ostentatiously. Hulek moved not just with a nomadic army, but with a nomadic empire. Hulek had a much larger engineering corps of Chinese and expanded it with European craftsmen to build bridges, catapults, and other machines of war. He also carried a larger medical corps and many more scribes and clerks to administer the larger army. In contrast to his grandfather's warriors, who fed themselves as they crossed the land, Hulek's caravans included carts laden with wheat, rice, and wine to feed the many different kinds of military men now in his command. For Hulek, the ultimate prize was to conquer the Arab cultural and financial capital of Baghdad. But to get there, he had to reassert Mongol authority over several rebellious areas en route. The most difficult of these was to conquer the strongholds of the Nizari Ismailis, a heretical Muslim sect of Shiites, more commonly known in the West as the Assassins. They were holed up in perhaps as many as 100 unconquered mountain fortresses stretching from Afghanistan to Syria, the most important of which was Alamut, the Eagle's Nest, in northern Persia. Members followed without question the orders of their hereditary leader, who was known by many titles, such as Imam, the Grand Master, or Old Man of the Mountain. Because they believed that God chose the Imam, he was therefore infallible. He needed no education, since everything he did, no matter how odd it might appear to mortals, was considered divinely inspired. His followers accepted seemingly irrational acts, frequent changes of the law, and even the reversal of the most sacred precepts as evidence of God's plan for humanity. Despite the lack of a conventional army, the Ismaili sect exercised tremendous political power through a highly sophisticated system of terror and assassination. And the secrecy and success of the group bred many myths, making it still today difficult to factor out the truth. The cult apparently had one simple and effective political strategy. Kill anyone, particularly leaders or powerful people who opposed them in any way. The cult recruited young men who were willing to die in their attacks with the assurance that they would achieve instant entry into paradise as martyrs of Islam. The Chinese, Persian, and Arabic sources all relate the same account
of how young men were lured by ample quantities of hashish and other earthly delights that awaited them in the special gardens of the cult's castles and fortresses. This was the foretaste of the paradise that awaited them, if they died in the Grand Master's service. He then trained them and controlled them with a steady supply of hashish to keep them obedient and make them fearless. Supposedly, because of the importance of narcotics for the Ismailis, the people around them called them hashashin, meaning the hashish users. Over time, this name became modified into the word assassin. Whether the killers had actually used hashish to inspire them or not, the name spread into many languages as the word for the murderer of high officials. Earlier, in the time of Genghis Khan's first invasion of the region, the Grand Master willingly swore obedience to the Mongols. In the following decades, the assassins flourished in the power vacuum created by Genghis Khan's defeat of the Turkic Sultan of Khwarizm, and then the withdrawal of most of the Mongol forces. By the time Mongkhan ascended the throne, the assassins feared that the return of a large Mongol army might interfere with their newfound powers. In what may have been only a pretext for Huleg's attack, some chroniclers wrote that the Grand Master sent a delegation to Karakorum ostensibly to offer submission to Mongkhan, but actually trained to kill him. The Mongols had turned them away and prevented the assassination, but because of it, Mongkhan decided to crush the sect permanently and tear down their fortresses. Before Huluk's army reached the assassin strongholds, the drunken and debauched Grand Master was murdered by disgruntled members of his own entourage and replaced by his equally incapable son. Huleg assessed the difficulty of capturing the heavily fortified castles one by one, and he devised a simple and more direct plan. Because of the sacred role of the Grand Master, Huleg concentrated on capturing him with a combination of massive military might and the offer of clemency if he should surrender. The Mongols bombarded the Ismaili stronghold, and the Mongol warriors proved capable of scaling the steepest escarpments to surprise the defenders of the fortress. The combination of force, firepower, and the offer of mercy worked. And on November 19, 1256, on the first anniversary of his coming to power, the Imam surrendered to the Mongols. Once Huleg had control of the Imam, he paraded him from Ismaili castle to Ismaili castle to order his followers to surrender. To encourage the cooperation of the imam and keep him happy until the end of the campaign, Huleg indulged his obsessive interest in watching camels fight and mate, and he supplied him with girls. In the spring of 1257, once the assassin's castle had been taken, the Imam recognized his loss of usefulness to the Mongols, and he requested permission to travel to Karakorum to meet with the great Khan Monk himself, perhaps to work out some plan for his own survival. Huleg sent him on the long journey to Mongolia, but once the Imam arrived there, Monk refused to see him. Instead, the Mongol escort took the Imam and his party out to the mountains near Karakorum and stomped them to death. With the extermination of the assassins, Huleg's army had an open route to Baghdad, the largest and richest city in the Muslim world. Whereas the Ismailis occupied the terrorist fringe of the Muslim world, the grand metropolis of Baghdad on the Tigris River reigned as its center, the mother of cities. Mecca, in the middle of Arabia, remained Islam's sacred city, but it was too isolated from the centers of population to function as an important political or commercial center. With the founding of Baghdad in 762, a little more than a century after the foundation of Islam, the Arab world found its metropolitan focus under the Abbasid dynasty of caliphs, who ruled as the titular head of the entire Muslim world.
the present Abbasid leader, ruled as the caliph, the 37th successor to the Prophet Muhammad. And therefore, in addition to being the most powerful secular ruler in the Muslim world, he had the position as the symbolic leader of all Muslims. He served as virtually a combination emperor and pope. Baghdad was the city of Scheherazade, the legendary teller of the tales known as the Arabian Nights, or the Thousand and One Nights. And for 500 years, the wealth of the Muslim world poured into the city, where the caliphs lavished it on palaces, mosques, schools, private gardens, and public fountains. Baghdad was a city of luxurious baths and overflowing bazaars. In addition to meeting the needs of its Muslim majority, the city served as the religious center for many Christians, who erected churches, and a cultural center for Jews, who built numerous synagogues and schools. The metropolis spilled out along both sides of the Tigris River, which were connected by a bridge, while massive walls protected the heart of the city. In classic Mongol diplomacy, before mounting an attack on the caliph, Hulag sent envoys with a list of legal grievances against him. Hulag accused the caliph of not sending an army to assist in the suppression of the Ismaili assassin sect, even though he had once sworn allegiance to Genghis Khan. In Mongol eyes, the caliph was as much a rebellious vassal as the imam, and he possibly faced the same fate. If the caliph did not immediately atone for his misdeeds by surrendering to Mongol rule, Hulag threatened to conquer his city and capture him. The caliph seemed as incapable of understanding the danger of the Mongols as the imam had been, and scoffed at what he felt were the Mongols' preposterous demands. He defiantly announced that the entire Muslim world would rise up to defend the independence of the caliph, and that they would not permit an infidel nation to occupy the Arab capital of Baghdad. He swore that Muslims as far away as the Maghreb along the Atlantic coast of Morocco would rush to kill the Mongol invaders if they continued in their campaign. Neither God nor the Muslim people, he defiantly claimed, would allow Baghdad to fall into the hands of non-believers. In November 1257, unconvinced of the caliph's power to speak for either God or the entire Muslim population, Hulag began to march toward Baghdad. He approached more cautiously than his grandfather would have done, but nevertheless, with the same set of proven Mongol strategies and tactics. To supplement his own army, Hulag summoned the armies of the vassal states of Armenia and Georgia, as well as a variety of Turkic tribes. Thus, while the main army approached in a wide arc from the north and the east, the others approached from the north and west. Although the Tigris and Euphrates rivers had historically served as natural barriers to foreign attacks on Mesopotamia, the Mongols easily moved back and forth across the rivers with a series of pontoon boats. As the invading armies advanced, they set the local population to flight toward the safety of the fortified city. By the final week of January 1258, the invading armies had encircled the city and occupied the extensive suburbs beyond the city walls, filling the city to its maximum with refugees. Before commencing the attack, Hulag sought to exploit political, religious, and ethnic divisions within Baghdad by forging secret ties to the Christians within the city. Because his mother and his two wives were Christians, as well as many of his own men, Hulag cultivated contacts and nourished respect within the Christian communities across the Middle East, and he had maintained good relations with his Christian vassal kingdoms, Georgia and Armenia. Taking advantage of these connections, Christian envoys secretly slipped back and forth between the city and the Mongol camp, bringing vital reconnaissance to Hulag, and carrying back promises of special treatment to the Christians and other minorities in the city. As a sign of the special favor that the Christians would enjoy under his rule, Huleg exempted Christian priests from kowtowing at court, since they bowed only to God. Huleg exploited the fears of the Christians of Baghdad as a small minority in a sea of potentially hostile